Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Reckless Disregard and Risk of Patent Infringement Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On February 23, 2011, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Global Tech Appliances versus SEB SA. A federal statute allows the owner of a patent to sue those who infringe on the patent and anyone who actively induces infringement. The question in this case is whether the federal statute only applies to someone who specifically intends to encourage patent infringement, or whether it is sufficient that a person recklessly disregarded the risk that a patent would be infringed. To discuss the case, we have Professor F. Scott Keefe, who is a member of the faculty at the George Washington University Law School. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Keefe.
Hi, and welcome to the Federalist Society podcast for Global Tech Appliances versus SEB. My name is Scott Keefe. I'm a law professor at George Washington University Law School in Washington, D.C., and Ray and Louise Knowles Senior Fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. The Global Tech case is another one of the Supreme Court patent cases. The Supreme Court has increased its interest in hearing patent cases, and that seems to be in part because the court feels that the Federal Circuit is not doing the right thing on these cases. I point that out because almost all of these cases do not involve questions the Supreme Court normally would be focusing on, like constitutional law questions or questions of relative powers of the federal government and state governments, or powers of the governments generally over the people and civil rights. That is to say, these cases really boil down to questions of patent policy and maybe statutory construction. So they are, in that sense, a little bit afield of normal Supreme Court action. The issue that arises in this case is the doctrine of inducement of infringement. The basic idea here is that for several areas of intellectual property, including patents, we think of a direct infringement case as a case being brought against somebody who is infringing the intellectual property right itself, and an indirect infringement case as a case being brought against somebody who is basically helping a third party to infringe. There generally are two types of indirect infringement, inducement and contributory, and this case is about inducement. Inducement is a concept that grew up in the case law, but is codified in the 1952 Patent Act, Section 271B. Section 271B explicitly includes a cause of action for inducement to infringe, and 271C, a companion section, for contributory infringement. And those sections were explicitly added to the statute because the Supreme Court, in its antitrust jurisprudence over the 30s and 40s, had basically eroded those doctrines. So those doctrines were codified in the statute to make clear that they should persist. In this case, as is often the case in inducement matters, you have a defendant who has found a set of customers, large stores, that sell commercial products, and those customers sell to the consuming population the product in issue. But the defendant makes the product who sells to the big stores who sell to the public. And so the direct infringers are the public who use the product, the consumers, the many individual homes and restaurants. In this case, the product is a whole fryer, a deep fryer. The defendant in the case is a company that provides the deep fryer to stores like Montgomery Ward who then sells these deep fryers to customers and restaurants. The inducement facts in this case turn out to not smell so good. The defendant bought a product from outside the United States rather than from inside the United States, and this matters because people often mark their products with patents that would be infringed by the making, using, or selling of those products. But of course, patents are domestic, so a product sold outside of the U.S. would not likely be marked with U.S. patent numbers. The defendant bought the plaintiff's product from outside of the United States, reverse engineered it, and then began selling their own version of it in the United States. The defendants said to their patent lawyer, please do a search to tell us whether this product would infringe any patents. The patent lawyer apparently did a search, did not find infringement, and so the defendants argue, look, we had no reasonable belief that we were out infringing somebody's patent, and so it doesn't make sense for us to be liable for inducement. The appellate court opinion that's being reviewed by the Supreme Court would have none of that argument, basically saying, wait a minute, you went and bought a sample from outside the U.S. knowing that it wouldn't have a patent number on it. You then told your patent lawyer to conduct a search, and your patent lawyer was not told that this was a product that you had reverse engineered. Had you told your patent lawyer that it was a product that was reverse engineered, your patent lawyer might have begun the search by searching the patents owned by the plaintiff's corporation. And that would have made it much more likely that the patent lawyer would have found the relevant patent. As a result, the appellate court thought this was a strong case for inducement. The Supreme Court oral argument last week seemed to go actually in about the same direction. The Supreme Court justices seemed very troubled by the notion that the defendant had asked for a patent search, but had not told the patent attorney that it was a reverse-engineered product, and had not told the patent attorney which product had been reverse-engineered. There seemed to be a great degree of skepticism on the court that this was, in effect, a way to whitewash the search, or to predetermine the outcome of the search. The legal issue in the case could be thought of as complicated. There could be some questions about statutory construction. What does 271B really mean when it uses the phrase active inducement? There are some debates out there about the relationship between the scope of 271B inducement and the scope of 271C contributory infringement. There are, of course, many cases out there on both sides of the issue on inducement, and so there are a range of linguistic arguments that have been made about whether any particular linguistic framework captures too many causes of action or too few causes of action. The consensus seems to be that there should be a cause of action for inducement. After all, that's the whole reason the statute was written, but that it should not cover very attenuated interactions among people. After all, we all live in an interconnected world, and we all help each other to some extent, and yet we all should not be liable for inducement of infringement. It is possible that the Supreme Court decides this case in a rather summary fashion simply because the facts are not particularly compelling for the defendant. The defendant's argument, the petitioner in this case, the defendant's argument is that the linguistic framework that the Federal Circuit used is too broad, and while that argument has appeal, the Supreme Court justices were very, very skeptical that just about any linguistic framework that would still protect preserve the notion of inducement of infringement would also end up capturing this particular defendant. So this is maybe a distinction without a difference in this case, and that leaves the Supreme Court in a position where it can write a fairly narrow opinion. Now, some broader questions that might come up but were not seriously discussed in the oral argument but have been floating out there among academics and commentators include also the question about inducement to breach contract and whether there should be a relationship between the inducement in cause of action in the patent setting and intentional interference with contractual relationships in the contract setting. There are some differences, of course, between the contract setting and the patent setting when it comes to inducement. One big difference, of course, is that patents are in rem, that is to say they're enforceable against the world, whereas contracts are purposefully designed to be very contextual. They are, after all, an agreement unique between the parties and not otherwise enforceable against the world. And so we might want to err on the side of making it harder to bring a cause of action for interference with contract, which are going to vary highly among contracts, than we would for patents, which are enforceable against all members of the society. So that would be one difference. And another major difference is that the basic policy reason for allowing inducement to infringe is precisely because in cases where there are many, many customers or many, many even wholesale or retail stores, it can become very, very hard for patentees to meaningfully enforce their patent rights against every one of those infringers. The inducement cause of action allows them to find somebody further upstream of commerce, the person who's actually designing the product that is infringing. And that's what happened in this case. This is the sweet spot, in fact, for patent inducement arguments. This is the person who's introducing into the stream of commerce the infringing product and, in fact, reverse engineered it purposefully to copy the patentee's product. So those are some of the issues. We'll see how the case comes out. My own prediction is that this is a very, very hard case for the petitioner to win, a very hard case for a meaningful change in the law. But there are some broad legal questions out there, and the Federal Circuit has itself been wrestling with the inducement standard. It, a few years ago, had an in-bank case called DSU, in which it seemed to set a fairly high standard for inducement, focusing on an infringer's specific intent to cause the legal outcome of infringement rather than just the actions that happen to be adjudicated as infringing. And in the Global Tech case, the Federal Circuit had backed off from that DSU standard somewhat by talking about deliberate indifference. And those linguistic frameworks are the topic of the cert petition in this case. They are the topic of most of the amicus briefs and party briefs in this case, the Global Tech case argued yesterday, but the oral argument did not really focus on most of those linguistic frameworks and instead seemed to focus on just trying to decide the case. So if the Supreme Court just decides the case, this would be, I think, an easy one to affirm without articulating much of a standard or much of a gloss on the existing standards as they stand.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.